Our next speaker is Don Friedman, Senior Policy Analyst at the Community Services Society in New York. Don?
Thank you. First, I want to appreciate the invitation to speak here today. This seems mandatory to start by saying this, something that makes some reference to Kumbaya. I just want to say I am a folk singer in my parallel life. I know Kumbaya, and welfare reform was no Kumbaya. I also want to mention preliminarily that I was recently on the radio, on a radio program with Robert Rector from the Heritage Foundation, and he called my ideas psychotic. Today, I assure you that I intend to be conciliatory, non-antagonistic, even though Professor Mead has anticipated pretty much everything I was going to say and rejected it all out of hand. And also, lastly, by way of introduction and a little more serious, I want to say that my remarks are informed in large measure by my 20 years of experience as a legal services attorney representing poor people, largely in benefits areas, and more recently by work that includes having been a founder of a group called Project Fair in New York City that has a table in the waiting room where fair hearings are held in New York City and tries to give people assistance and, if possible, line up representation and gives us a sense, and I do a shift there at least monthly, gives a sense of the kinds of issues that people are seeing. I provided two handouts. They were the ones with the scarlet L for liberal on the table there. from the University of Chicago's Chapin Hall and from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Some of the what's in there and what I'm going to talk about looks like it may have been more appropriate for the first panel looking backwards at what has happened with welfare reform, but it seems that you obviously have to think about what has happened and how you respond to it in order to engage in the discussion about what we should do moving forward to the next administration and possibly to the impending Democratic majority state Senate. And I will couple the findings in those materials with some of my thoughts for the next administration's priorities. Since this is the second panel, I won't talk about my perceptions of what has happened with welfare reform. I won't say that after a number of years of reductions in child poverty and reductions in adult poverty and increases in female-headed household employment, that since roughly 2000, every one of those measures has ticked the other way, definitely not to the pre-welfare reform numbers, but definitely going the other way. I also won't mention that when we talk about people getting out of, somebody needs to say this, when we talk about people getting out of poverty, we're talking about a three-person family. When they were earning under $16,000, they were not poor. I'm sorry, they were poor. When their income from employment or whatever source goes to $16,001 or thereabouts, they're not poor. Does anybody is part of a three-person family that has an income of $16,000 and are they not poor? Anyway, so whenever we talk about people being poor and not poor in this context, think in those terms. They now have income of a three-person family has income over $16,000. And that's a little bit of a reality check on all of the data about in and out of poverty. most of the people who have gotten jobs are no better off, I would submit, and many are materially worse off in terms of the standard of living that they are able to support post leaving welfare. 75% of leavers experience serious material hardship, including inability to pay the rent, inability to meet utility costs, and suffering from food insecurity, meaning that inability to eat fully and feed their family is a constant risk. and the engagement in work has been sporadic. I won't note that deep poverty, meaning people at half the poverty level, has increased in recent years. And lastly, I won't note that moms without what we might call disconnected moms, without either employment or access to benefits, has increased significantly. Before looking a little more forward, I will also say that it is true that in New York there is not there is a protection that might be read as meaning that there is a guaranteed entitlement to assistance. To me, I have to say, I said I was going to be non-antagonistic, I have to say that it's remarkable to me how disconcerted so many people are that New York has what I think should be one of the things we're most proud of, which is Article 17 of our state constitution that says it's the obligation of this state to care for the needy. The courts have interpreted it in ways that I think don't go far enough, but at least there's that protection, the mandate for a safety net. And I think it's something that we in New York should be very proud of, and not certainly not thinking about tinkering with. Let me move forward a little with some of the findings and some of my thoughts for the priorities of the next administration. First, and maybe I'll take the most controversial one to start with, a major element of caseload reduction has not just been current recipients leaving the rolls, but a sharp reduction in applicants and a reduction in applications accepted. Couple this with findings by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities that currently about 48% of people who are eligible for TANF don't get it, compared to in the early 1990s, about 80% of those who seemed eligible for TANF were getting it. Now, some might argue that that's a good thing, that people aren't turning to TANF. I would say that I think that that is a function of intimidation and stigmatization, misinformation, and huge administrative barriers so that people in dire and desperate need cannot pursue and cannot receive benefits that they need and are entitled to. And there's very concrete evidence of suffering as a result of that. I don't see that decline as, and I know I stand perhaps in a minority here, I don't see that decline as a favorable outcome of welfare reform. So my first priority would be, not necessarily in importance, but in order here, is to make clear to people that public assistance is there for those who need it, that we will work on improving employability, but we will also work on helping you to pay your rent and feed your family. Next, and this is something that's I was going to say was universally acknowledged, except for Professor Mead, we might have some disagreement here, and that is about the significance of the fact that a very significant portion of the people receiving public assistance have have serious barriers and challenges to employment. The two leading ones in Center on Budget research are very low levels of education, serious education deficits. Less than half of the people on adults on welfare now have a high school have a high school diploma, and secondly, very high levels of mental disability. There are serious other barriers like domestic violence and other physical health problems, substance abuse, and other disabled household members. These also don't tend to come singly. They tend to come in groups, so many people have multiple barriers. I see four priorities. I'm sure there are others, but four priorities that flow from, for the next administration, that flow from those facts. Number one is that we have to do a better job of identifying barriers. And I know that there have been efforts across the state to improve on this, and I think that's a good thing, and I think it would be good to improve on it more. And that is that we do a good job up front and wherever appropriate to try to analyze, assess, evaluate, diagnose, and detect disabilities and other barriers to a family's moving ahead. Often at the Project FAIR table that I referenced at the beginning, we see people with whom a one-minute conversation would reveal that this is a person who cannot readily, at this point in time, pursue employment, and we find that they have been diagnosed or found by the agency as fully employable without limitation. And that we need to improve on how we evaluate that. Second, an obvious follow-up to that is that we need to do a better job of addressing those barriers in terms of treatment, rehabilitation, therapy, et cetera. I recognize, as Russ has pointed out, and it's eminently clear that I think, ironically, the Deficit Reduction Act and the HHS regs have made it harder to provide those kinds of services. Excuse me. Next, and this one apparently is controversial, is that there needs to be greater access to education and training. This also is made much tougher by the statute and the regs. There may be controversy and disagreement about findings about education and how it fits in here vis-a-vis the work first requirement, but we also know that virtually every increment in educational achievement, every upward increment in educational achievement, enhances employability, pay level, and job retention. Lastly, with regard to this issue, I would say that we have to do a better job of compliance with the Americans with Disability Act. I think that the way that the welfare system is administered is rife with failures to adequately recognize and accommodate disabilities. Let me move on for, I'm running out of time, but I just have a couple more things to say. Something that relates closely to the issue of disability is the issue of sanctions. And far from going in the direction of what we need more drastic and draconian sanctions, what I would say is that we now know more and more through research that the people who tend to be sanctioned tend to be people with multiple barriers. It sort of seems to me like it should be intuitive, but in this state we have a term that came about in this administration, I'm not sure, called the happily sanctioned, which suggests that people who are sanctioned do so knowing the consequences, knowing that in fact it doesn't matter to them because of other scams they're pulling or other things going on in their lives. In fact, the research shows that most of the people who get sanctioned are people with serious problems. They have disabilities, they have very serious educational deficits, literacy, English proficiency, mental problems. That's who they are and that's why they get sanctioned. Noncompliance is not so much a function of bad attitude as a function of limited capacity and other serious problems. This should not even need to be said, but lots of research shows that people who get sanctioned tend to suffer for it. The reason it needs to be said is because, again, to counter that notion of the happily sanctioned, they're not so happy because they're more likely to be evicted, they're more likely to face homelessness, their kids are more likely to suffer serious health consequences as a result of the sanction. So one of the things we need to do is work to reduce sanctions. And by the way, I think the state has an interest in this. And in fact, some recent actions by the legislature, by the OTDA, and by some of the local districts, bears out an interest in reducing sanctions. Why is there a state interest? Not just the humane interest, but also the fact that if we get a family participating, that's good for the participation rates. It's better, by the way, to get a family participating than to full family sanction them in terms of just the pure arithmetic of participation rates. It might be more expensive, but I think it's more humane, it's better for the family, and it's better for the participation rate numbers. I will mention, since the Suffolk County Commissioner is here, that one of the promising things going on is an effort they're doing to address sanctions, and maybe the commissioner will mention that. OTDA is also now distributing money that was passed by the legislature to provide something called intensive case services that hopefully will help address these some of the sanction problems. Just a couple things in closing. One I won't get into because there does seem to be fairly broad consensus about is the need to make work pay. That when people do get jobs, so many of the people who get jobs now are living in poverty and hardship. We need to do various things, the EITC and some of the other things that have been discussed here, to help make sure that people who are working are moving out of poverty. The last thing I'll mention, maybe this is even more controversial than the applications thing, is the welfare grant has not been, the rent portion of the welfare grant was increased a few years ago, and a certain amount, not adequate, but a certain amount. The rest of the grant has not been increased in 16 years. If you believe that welfare should be completely abolished, then that's not problematic. If you in any way believe that there are some people who legitimately need assistance, whether for shorter or longer term, then if you take a look at the grant, there's no realistic way that a family in good faith trying hard to comply with the rules and getting ahead could possibly live on the amount that the family is now receiving, and that needs to be addressed. Thanks.